Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi in a helicopter crash.
This crash also involves the Iranian foreign minister and other officials who are riding along with Raisi after a trip to the Azerbaijan border.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky marks 5 years on the job.
We defeated Russia in the battle for minds of the world.
And more than 60 years after being chosen for the astronaut program, America's first black astronaut candidate finally goes into space.
2-1-0. Ignition. And liftoff. Liftoff!
Today is Monday, May 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. A helicopter carrying Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, the country's foreign minister, and other officials apparently crashed in the mountainous northwest reaches of Iran on Sunday, sparking a massive rescue operation in a fog-shrouded forest as the public was urged to pray. They were on their way back from a visit to the border of Azerbaijan to inaugurate a dam. That's Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei saying we should pray and pray for the health of this group of servicemen, at the head of which is the respected and honorable president. Iranian state TV is showing pictures of Iranians praying across the country, but the reality of what's happening on the ground in Iran, given the news, is much more complicated. Joining us now to sort it all out is Alex Vatanka, the founding director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute. He specializes in Middle Eastern regional security affairs with a particular focus on Iran. So tell us about him. He's been there since 2021. What kind of president has he been?
So Ebrahim Raisi is basically someone who his entire adult life has been one of him occupying one position or another in the Islamic Republic from basically age of 20. Because of his connections and the timing of the revolution in 1979, he comes of age at a time where the regime that takes over from the Shah is desperate for technocrat bureaucrats who could occupy positions in the new regime. Here's someone who comes from a connected family with the new Khomeini-led regime. He gets into the judicial branch early on, spends most of his career in the judiciary. At one point, he is an instrumental player in essentially sentencing to death thousands of political prisoners in the late 1980s, something that the opposition and the Iranian public in general haven't forgiven him for. And in the last decade, there was a sudden rush to elevate him. And, you know, one can speculate why that is, but the fact is he was suddenly brought in and given more senior positions as time went on. The Supreme Leader has been very open about the fact that Raisi is a favorite one. And if you caught the Supreme Leader on your side, then basically anything is possible. And that has been his story of the last few years. So he gets the presidency in an election in 2021 that is, you know, seen widely as being engineered for him to win. Nobody else was allowed to run, essentially. Is that essentially got this presidency on a silver platter. He is someone that at least a part of the regime has trust in, put their faith in. They want him to go all the way and maybe one day essentially succeed Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei himself. And that's where it's sort of some of the speculation in Iran today's been all about, you know, was there some foul play here? Did some of the domestic opponents of Raisi, people who don't want to see him become Supreme Leader, perhaps engage in foul play here? And that's where we're at right now.
What happens if it's true that he was killed in this crash? There's a vacuum now in the bureaucracy because it wasn't just him. It was also the foreign minister.
Right. Look, I would be very careful in calling this a moment of power vacuum in the Islamic Republic. The simple truth is the president has very limited powers when it comes to key strategic issues of both domestic or foreign. The real decision makers are the office of the Supreme Leader, where the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is still there, and the Revolutionary Guards. The generals and the guards, they are the other most important decision makers, and they're not being impacted by this as such. The foreign minister and the president, they are symbolically very important, but they're essentially messengers more than anything else in terms of representing the views of the regime on an official level. Them being gone, if that's the case, doesn't mean there will be discontinuity tomorrow. You can't expect Iranian policies to change anytime soon because they are not set by Raisi or the foreign minister. They just implement them and speak in their defense to world opinion. That said, if there is going to be evidence of foul play, some hampering with that helicopter, again, I don't think the regime will come out in an open infighting. What I think will happen is there will be intense power competition, but a lot of that, I suspect, will happen behind the scenes initially. Whether they can control it and whether that spills out and public can view it remains to be seen. But the fact is Raisi does have some serious opponents inside the regime and even among the hardliners, the camp where he comes from. So what you've seen in the last few years is the regime has essentially put all the reformists and moderates aside. They've been eliminated one way or another. So the real fight inside the regime is among the various colors of hardliners that operate inside the regime.
So a lot of people say he was, as you pointed out, the favorite to take over from Khamenei. Who do you think or do you speculate might be number two?
I mean, the two names that have most frequently been mentioned on the short list to take over from Khamenei is Ebrahim Raisi, the president, and Khamenei's son, Mojtaba Khamenei. Mojtaba Khamenei is still very much a man behind the scenes.
What about the citizens of Iran? We've seen video from state television of people praying as they were told to do for the president, but what's happening off camera? Do you think people are going to be happy about this?
I mean, obviously, the Iranian state-run media will do their best to portray this as a moment of you know, anxiety for the Iranian public. I think what I'm picking up on social media so far suggests that you know, either people don't care simply, or they're essentially celebrating because Raisi was not someone that ever got the genuine vote and support of the Iranian public and is more associated with some of the worst policies and excesses, including execution of thousands of political prisoners in the 1980s. And for those reasons, I don't see sort of mass mourning if it turns out that he was killed in that accident.
Hmm. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Alex Vitanka, founding director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute. We're following these other stories from around the world. Elon Musk traveled to Indonesia's resort island of Bali on Sunday to launch Starlink satellite internet service in the world's largest archipelago nation. The Congo military on Sunday said it had thwarted an attempted coup near the offices of President Felix Tshisekedi in Kinshasa involving foreigners and Congolese citizens. An army spokesman said several Americans and a British man were part of the group. The Dominican Republic voted Sunday with President Luis Abinader poised for comfortable re-election on the back of widespread support for his tough stance on migration from Haiti next door. The two nations share the Caribbean island of Hispaniola. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, President Joe Biden drastically increased tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles on steel and aluminum and semiconductors. The move follows his administration's review of former President Donald Trump's trade policies toward China. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Rakaswara looks at how the two presidential candidates differ in their approach.
Talking tough on China is one of the few areas that both Democrats and Republicans agree on, including President Joe Biden.
For years, the Chinese government has poured state money into Chinese companies across a whole range of industries. Steel and aluminum, semiconductors, electric vehicles, solar panels. The industries of the future.
And his predecessor, former President Donald Trump.
China's eating our lunch right now. And they went away from what I was doing. They're eating our lunch.
Both Biden and Trump say they want to punish China for trade practices that violate international rules. This week, Biden quadrupled tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles to 100%, tripled levies on some steel and aluminum products to 25%, and doubled the rate on semiconductors to 50%.
And we'll counter China's overcapacity in these industries. And we're making major investments in clean American steel and aluminum.
Biden made the move after reviewing Trump's tariff policies. Trump said, too little, too late.
They should have done it a long time ago. But they've also got to do it on other vehicles, and they have to do it on a lot of other products.
Ahead of the November election, where the two men are locked in a rematch, both Biden and Trump are keen to highlight that their policies toward Beijing will benefit American workers. Broad tariffs on Chinese imports from seafood to consumer electronics were first imposed by Trump. Biden has maintained some of them, targeting key sectors like clean energy. This is in line with his plan to boost production of domestic EVs and other technologies meant to fight climate change and to dominate high-tech manufacturing industries. Another key difference is that Biden harmonizes his efforts with allies, including the G7, group of seven industrialized nations.
The Trump administration was quite willing to use tariffs to get better deals. They were less willing to invest at home to try to create alternate supply chains. And they were probably even less willing to work with allies to try to build those supply chains.
Trump says his broader, bigger, billions of dollars tariff approach is better, while Biden says his surgical attack is more effective. Either way, Beijing promises retaliation, and the American voters will show their preference in November. Patsy Rakaswara, VOA News, Washington.
Volodymyr Zelensky marks 5 years in power as Ukraine's president. Zelensky, a comedian turned politician, was sworn in on May 20th, 2019, in the country's parliament. He's been a super player on the world stage because of the Russian invasion, now in its third year.
We defeated Russia in the battle for minds of the world.
As Zelensky begins his sixth year in the presidency, let's go a little deeper. Joining us now to talk about the president is Sergei Sanovich, a Hoover Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. So let's start with who is Volodymyr Zelensky? Where did he come from?
Well, I think he's definitely an interesting and now historic figure. Many people know that he's originally a showman, a comedian. But I think what is also important and a little bit less known, that he was a very successful entrepreneur. He created the largest entertainment company in Ukraine. It was active actually not just in Ukraine, but across all post-Soviet states, including, by the way, Russia, and it included Zelensky. But the company was bigger than just him. It was not just his show. There were a lot of people, different shows on TV, in person, and so forth. And he created a very successful and fairly large, for at least entertainment industry standards, business. And also, I think important and maybe you can even say unusual for entertainer, he was a real family man, very committed and devoted to his family, which gave, when he became president, Ukraine a brilliant first lady.
How do the people of Ukraine see him? They like him, right?
Well, he was originally a popular presidential candidate, but again, in a very competitive system. He had strong opponents. He won over the incumbent and incumbent party. And he created his own new party. And then during parliamentary elections, it won a majority. But again, it's very important to emphasize, you know, the difference here, right? You know, this experience and this ability to create a political movement behind his ideas helped him a lot. And, you know, even during this very challenging time of Russian invasion, Ukrainian government is run rather smoothly, I would say.
As he begins his sixth year as president, what do you think he has to face? What do you think he has to face in the year to come?
Well, I think that the challenges that he faces are formidable. The one that everybody understands is just a pure military threat. Continued and increasing military threat from Russia. Putin is not slowing down. He's increasing military capacity, recruiting people, producing weapons, procuring weapons in other countries such as Iran, North Korea, and others. This military threat, it's not diminished, and I would argue it is actually increasing. But it's not the only one. Russia not just tries to annex more and more Ukrainian territory and destroy Ukrainian army and military production. They're also destroying civilian infrastructure, killing a lot of civilian people. You know, this big rockets that fly from deep into Russia, into Ukrainian cities such as Odessa, or Kyiv, or even Lviv. They make it much harder for the population of Ukraine to weather this war and for Ukrainian economy to remain afloat. I think it demonstrates remarkable resilience, but it's tough, particularly with electricity production that Russia particularly targets electricity plants. And so Ukraine has rolling outages of electricity. So the economic challenges of sustaining the budget, of sustaining the military, because Ukraine needs to train new soldiers, buy additional weapons that they have a deficit of, and so forth. This is a real challenge.
What does he have to watch out for, do you think, internationally?
I would say, I mean, the last challenge, I think, before Zelensky's, rather unpredictable, if you will, sort of international environment, where, you know, tensions in the Middle East and tensions in East Asia, they sort of suck the air and suck the attention, particularly of the United States, the most formidable ally that Ukraine has, but also in Europe, it's hard to predict what the landscape would be after the elections to the European Parliament and then forthcoming elections in Germany, in France, and so forth. And of course, the biggest unknown of all is elections in the United States.
Great. Thank you so very much for the time.
A pleasure to talk to you, and look forward to see it on VOA website.
Okay, I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thank you.
Sergey Sanovich, a Hoover Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Taiwan's Lai Ching-te has been sworn in as the new president Monday.
Yu,
That puts him at the helm of the self-ruled island, also claimed by China, as Beijing ramps up military and political pressure on Taipei. And finally, Jeff Bezos' space company, Blue Origin, launched a 6-person crew, including the first U.S. black astronaut candidate from the 1960s. The launch from West Texas to the edge of space on Sunday resumed its centerpiece space tourism business for the first time since its suborbital New Shepard rocket was grounded in 2022. More now from Reuters correspondent Emma Jalee.
210.
The crew included Ed Dwight, the U.S.'s first black astronaut candidate in the 1960s, but who, until now, had never flown to space. He also became the oldest person in space at 90 years old and 8 months, surpassing actor William Shatner, who was 90 years old and 6 months at the time of his Blue Origin flight. The crew were launched in a gumdrop-shaped capsule atop a rocket from the Blue Origin facilities near Van Horn, Texas. The rocket separated from the capsule, which then ascended more than 65 miles beyond the boundary of Earth's atmosphere. It returned to Earth under parachutes, capping a mission lasting roughly 10 minutes. One of the capsule's 3 parachutes did not fully inflate, a hitch that may draw scrutiny before the next mission. The grounding of New Shepard, Blue Origin's only active rocket, came after a mid-flight failure in September 2022 during an uncrewed research mission. After implementing changes mandated by the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, the New Shepard returned to flight in December 2023 with an uncrewed mission. The FAA did not immediately respond to questions about the New Shepard capsule's parachute and whether the agency would investigate. A Blue Origin spokesperson said the crew capsule is designed to safely land with one parachute and called the mission an overall success.
Reuters correspondent Emma Jalee. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. You can also download our apps from Google and Apple. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent visit to Ukraine, Secretary of State Antony Blinken laid out a plan for Ukraine to stand on its own feet, militarily, economically, democratically, so that America's support can transition to more sustainable levels.
First, we're helping to ensure that Ukraine has the military that it needs to succeed on the battlefield, to secure a just and lasting peace, and to deter future aggression.
Our goal is to lay a foundation so strong that it dispels any doubts about Ukraine's ability to impose punishing costs on those who try to take its territory, said Secretary Blinken. This includes eventual NATO membership. Second, we will ensure that Ukraine's economy not only survives but thrives, said Secretary Blinken. But for all the resources our government and others will invest in Ukraine's infrastructure, in its innovation, in its people, Ukraine's economic transformation will ultimately be driven by the private sector.
We're accelerating our efforts to help Ukraine attract more private investment, especially toward dynamic industries like technology, like energy, like agriculture, like defense. We're helping to lower the cost of doing business in Ukraine. Thanks to the provision of war risk insurance, more grain is being exported through the Black Sea today than before the war. And Ukraine's breadbasket is once again feeding the world.
Finally, the U.S. will help the Ukrainian people fully realize their democratic aspirations, said Secretary Blinken.
That's why we're working with the government and civil society groups to shore up Ukraine's election infrastructure. That way, as soon as Ukrainians agree the conditions allow, all Ukrainians, including those displaced by Russia's aggression, can exercise their right to vote. People in Ukraine and around the world can have confidence that the voting process is free, fair, secure.
The spirit of Ukrainians cannot be destroyed by a bomb or buried in a mass grave. It cannot be bought with a bribe or repressed with a threat, said Secretary Blinken. That's why Ukraine will succeed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.